Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by Don Klein, Douglas County Attorney. Besides his duties as county attorney, Mr. Klein also serves on the board of directors of Project Harmony, as well as on the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association. He graduated from the Creighton University School of Law in 1977. Among other topics, he'll discuss the challenges facing the Douglas County Attorney's Office. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 16, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Gary Kerr, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Today our forum features Douglas County Attorney Don Klein talking about the challenges facing his office in a time of what seems to be heightened criminal activity. Don Klein has tried many high-profile criminal cases for Douglas County, among them the murder conviction of Christopher Edwards and the slaying of his girlfriend Jessica O'Grady in 2006, the first jury trial in Nebraska where a murder conviction was obtained without the victim's body. Also, the conviction and death sentence for Roy Ellis and the death of 12-year-old Amber Harris. And now, the prosecution of Nico Jenkins, who was charged with murdering four people in August after he was released from prison. Don Klein was first elected county attorney in November 2006. Prior to that, he was chief of the Criminal Bureau with the Nebraska Department of Justice, and before that, he was chief deputy Douglas County attorney. He is a graduate of the Creighton University Law School. There is paper and pencil at your table. Write down your questions, which will be brought to me to read after Mr. Klein's remarks. So, join me in welcoming Don Klein.
Good afternoon. How's everybody this afternoon? Good. Thank you for getting me out of the courthouse for an hour today. I appreciate that. It's nice to be here. It's wonderful to be here with all of you. I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to visit with you, and I look forward. I guess the part that I look forward to the most is hearing some of the questions that you might have of me in this job that we do at the Douglas County Attorney's Office. I don't know if you know who's here today. But one of my colleagues that I work very closely with and is a very good friend of mine, Deb Gilg, the U.S. Attorney's here. I'd like to point that out because we work together in law enforcement, and it's a wonderful working relationship, and it's nice to have somebody in that position that works so well with local law enforcement. And also my chief deputy, Brenda Beadle, is here today, who you might have seen, and she does a lot of the work with me in running that office, and really I answer to her quite frequently, and so I try and do the best job that I can do in that regard also. I'll tell you, let's talk a little bit about the office for a few minutes, just so everybody knows a little bit about the background with the largest county attorney's office in the state of Nebraska and one of the larger law firms, really, in this area. We have 59 lawyers in the Douglas County Attorney's Office at this point in time. And I don't think sometimes people realize exactly what that job entails as being the county attorney of this populous county that we have here. We have a civil division that handles all the lawsuits against the county. Anytime anybody sues Douglas County, we represent the county in that capacity. We advise all the different county office holders. We do all the personnel work, labor work with regards to what occurs in Douglas County. We do all the commitments for the Board of Mental Health, which is, I think, a very important role that we play in the community. When a family contacts us and says, look, I've got a loved one who's has a mental illness, and we feel that they're being dangerous to themselves or to someone else, they won't get help. We have the capability to involuntarily commit that person to get them the help that they need with regard to our Board of Mental Health. It's a very busy position that we have. In Nebraska, the county attorney, as the elected, is the coroner for the county that they belong to. So you hear the term whenever there's a death in that occurs in Douglas County, we make a determination from a medical legal standpoint if there needs to be an autopsy. And you hear the term the Jenny Dugan Henricks is a deputy of ours. She is the acting coroner. That's because the county attorney is the coroner. So you hear the term, the acting county coroner is Jenny Dugan Henricks. So anytime there's a death that occurs in Douglas County, we are notified, and we make a determination if there needs to be an autopsy for medical legal reasons. Either that's a trauma death, if there could be a potential criminal case involved, or if there's a health question from the community's perspective, if there's something that's going on in the community that people are dying from, and we need to make sure that we find out what the cause of death is to stop whatever contagion could be going on in the county. That's part of our role. We contract with 5 physicians who do those autopsies for us. We also have, I really believe that the impact, one of the greatest impacts we can have as a county attorney is in changing somebody's life around, is in the juvenile court system. So we have 16 lawyers now in the juvenile court system of Douglas County that I have our deputies there. And it's extremely busy. They handle all the delinquency cases, all the status offenses, all the neglect, abuse cases from a juvenile court perspective, and then all the termination of parental rights, which is the most serious case that they handle up there. It's a very busy place. There are thousands of juveniles that we handle up in the juvenile court system. Then everybody else is down in the criminal division of the county attorney's office. And I think you're very well aware of what we do there. We file about 3,500 felonies a year in Douglas County. That's a lot of felonies. Felonies are crimes that are punished by over a year in the penitentiary. We have, I think the World Herald ran a recent article that told everyone and had the photos and on the paper of we had 32, I think we have 33 murder cases pending now, including 2 serial murders, the Nico Jenkins case and the Dr. Garcia case, which is somewhat unprecedented for Douglas County. And we've never quite been that busy. We've never had 2 serial murders at the same time, let alone 1. We also have 2 serial rapist cases pending, along with the myriad of other felonies that we have. We also handle all the domestic violence misdemeanors that occur in Douglas County. We have 3 lawyers that just handle those specific types of cases. So it's a tremendously busy case. Each lawyer has a caseload of maybe 80 to 100 cases, possibly. And the types of cases run the gamut from motor vehicle homicides, sexual assault cases, child abuse, sexual assaults of children, theft cases, burglaries, any type of felony that you can imagine are the type of cases that we handle. And we've tried to be, you know, I know we've seen a lot of things come out recently about the prison system and what do we do with these folks. We also have an area of our office with the criminal division that we handle. We have diversion cases. We divert people who are first-time offenders on nonviolent offenses as long as they make restitution and do whatever they're supposed to do, whatever rehabilitation they need. We have drug court, which has been very successful in handling people who have addiction issues, in treating that person and rather than sending them to the penitentiary, and that's been very successful. We have a young adult court. We have mental health diversion. So we have a lot of other aspects of the office to assist people and assist the citizens of Douglas County. But I think the thing that I've noticed, I was a deputy county attorney right out of law school back in 1978 for Pinky Knowles, and that's why, quite frankly, I have this job today, is that I was very fortunate to have mentors in my life that kind of pointed me in the right direction. That helped me. When I saw Pinky and I saw what he did and how he did it and how he handled himself and how he handled, quite frankly, all of us deputies in the office at the time, I had a lot of admiration for the man, and I had an admiration for the job. And I worked as a deputy for 5 years out of law school, went to private practice, and then when Jim Jansen was elected in 1990, I came back in the county attorney's office as the chief deputy. Jim asked me to come back, and I was very appreciative of that opportunity. And then in 2003, John Bruning asked me to come down and head the Criminal Bureau for the state of Nebraska, and I did that. But, you know, I wanted to be here in Omaha. And I always wondered if it was possible that I could sit in that office as the county attorney of Douglas County, and that was kind of my dream. After seeing Pinky and the way he handled it, So I said I want to run for this job, and I decided to do so. And fortunately for me, the people of Douglas County elected me in 2006, and I started serving as the county attorney in 2007. And I'm up this year to be my third term. So a very, very lucky person, because this job, I think, is a tremendous job to have. And I'm able to have very good people around me. Those 56 lawyers or 59 lawyers that we have in our office are truly dedicated public servants. I was able to pull my chief deputy out of retirement. She feels the same way I do with regards to the opportunity to serve. And I can't tell you how what a great feeling it is to stand up in a courtroom and be able to say what an honor it is to say, I represent the people of the state of Nebraska. I represent the people of Douglas County. That's my job. And that's an honor and a privilege to be able to do so. I still like to try cases. I do it regularly. I've had great opportunities to be able to be a trial lawyer over the years, and I still like to do so. I think I'd like to lead by example with the younger lawyers in my office in that regard. I get to do a lot of different things. I teach at Creighton University's Law School in both the fall and the spring semesters as an adjunct professor. I get to be I'm on the National Board of Directors of the National District Attorneys Association. I'm on their executive committee. I'm on the board of Project Harmony on that executive committee, the board of directors, the advisory board of Nebraska Organ Retrieval, which ties into the position of coroner. We're in such sad situations on many times in those individuals' deaths. And I always try to figure a way, if there's some way that we could take something positive out of this very sad situation that these families going through and help somebody else who we can help with an organ transplant, then we're trying to do everything we can to make that work without jeopardizing anything with regard to the autopsy or a criminal case. So those are some of the aspects of the job itself, a little bit about my position and the office itself. The things that I've noticed, though, that have changed from the time that I was a deputy back in 1978 to now, one thing that I've noticed is certainly the volume has increased. And it's just that I think the population of Douglas County is greater than it's ever been, of course. It's growing. We have some of the big city issues that we didn't maybe have before. When I was a deputy in the late 70s or early 80s, maybe we had it seemed like we only had a first-degree murder case maybe once every 6 months or so, and it was a big deal. Well, it's not the case anymore. We have quite a few cases all the time. And what I guess I would want to make sure that people don't get just used to that and say, well, that's just part of life here. It shouldn't be. It can't be. And we shouldn't let it be. That it's just an occurrence that happens, and it's just something we have to accept. It's part of being in a bigger metropolitan area, because it's not. And the other thing that I see that is the youth violence, is young people, which seemed maybe unimaginable 20 or 25 years ago, 15, 16, 14 years old, involved with not a high school fight in the parking lot. I'm talking about people with, you know, semi-automatic weapons, driving down the street and firing guns at people. And of course, an example of that is what happened yesterday. And it's so sad, so horrifying that something like that can happen in our community. But when you prosecute a case that involves young people or the death of young people, those are the child abuse cases, the Roy Ellis case, say the death of Amber Harris. I prosecuted Arthur Lee Gales, who was also convicted of two counts of first-degree murder and was sentenced to the death penalty for the death of Tramar and Latara Chandler, two children. He raped Latara, a 13-year-old girl, and strangled her, and Tramar, her little brother, he strangled and drowned. Asa Carter was a case I prosecuted clear back in 1991 or 92. It was a death of Naomi Lilly, a little 7-year-old girl who was raped and positionally asphyxiated. Those child cases that my chief deputy and I have, those cases, they never leave you. They're etched in your your soul, your mind. You don't forget about those kinds of things, those horrifying scenes, those unimaginable moments that you think of that this child lived through at the end of their life. So those kinds of cases obviously stick with you. But the violent crime that occurs with youth, we prosecuted about, 2 years ago, a 15, 16, and 17-year-old who went on a spree, started at 16th and Martha Streets, killed a young man in a driveway, Juan Silva. They went from right there to Dundee, and little Charlie Denton was getting some money out of his ATM machine in the Dundee parking lot there, and they approached his van, shot him. He survived. And they drove right around the corner there to 52nd Leavenworth and killed Terry Glensman as she was closing up the gas station there at 52nd Leavenworth Street. 15, 16, 17-year-old. Unimaginable. And you're sitting in a courtroom trying somebody for first-degree murder that's you look across and it's a 15-year-old. So those things I see differently, and it's extremely disturbing to see young people, anybody particularly, but young people specifically involved in those kinds of crimes, those kinds of violent acts. I think with the publicity that the Jenkins case has gotten, obviously it brings a lot of issues to the forefront in the news. And I can't really, it's a pending case. We can't really talk about that. But that case and the Garcia case have garnered national attention. In fact, in our office this morning, we had somebody from Dateline there. We couldn't talk to them about the case. They just wanted to introduce themselves to us. They said, we're following Omaha, we're following how these cases are handled, and we find them, quite frankly, fascinating from the standpoint of what took place, both of those types of cases. And then, of course, there's the history with both of those cases. I think that is very interesting to people. But I can't really go into too much detail with regard to those cases. But I guess I don't want to spend a whole lot of time up here just talking. I could talk about so many different issues, and I'd love to visit with you about whether it's forensic evidence or funny things that have taken place maybe at the courthouse or fascinating cases that we've handled. There are so many that I've had the opportunity to be exposed to that I think we could write a lot of books about some of the different aspects of many of the different cases that we've seen, and right here in Omaha, Nebraska, which I think sometimes surprises people. But I'd like to get your questions, or have you just ask me questions, and rather than me just be up here speaking and have some dialogue between you.
Are you in favor of arming teachers in schools? Would you support a ban on sales of handguns?
I was told there wouldn't be any hard questions today. And really, I don't think that's a hard one to me. I don't see that it's a good idea to start saying that we should hand out guns to teachers and have teachers armed in schools. I would like to think that we haven't gotten to that point where let's just arm everybody, including teachers or doctors in an emergency room or whoever. And so I guess I'm not in favor of a teacher necessarily having a gun. I think it poses other issues and problems, potential problems, if something would accidentally happen or if the teacher's gun was taken from them, or what sort of training are teachers going to have as to when the proper use of deadly force is what we have. We have situations that take place quite frequently. We do grand juries every time an officer uses deadly force and has to use deadly force to kill someone. And so that's how serious that is. And to say, well, let's arm teachers. And I'm not saying that some schools have security, school resource officers, so we have law enforcement presence in schools. But I hope it's not necessary, I guess, from the standpoint of arming teachers. And the other question, that was a two-part question. There was, something about gun sales also with that.
You have mentioned how much you love your job. What are your two top favorite and two least favorite parts about your job?
All right. I do love my job. Like I said, I've already told you one of the favorite things about my job is saying I represent the people of Douglas County. That's an honor and a privilege to do so. I think one of the neatest things about my job, a lot of the lawyers in our office are young lawyers that come out of law school. And to watch them grow, to be able to give them, to teach them that we do, the chief and myself and some of the other more senior lawyers, to see them get to be better trial lawyers and to further their career is very gratifying. And as I said, you know, I go to the, you know, it's my wife and I will go to the store or something at night, and or I'll be somewhere, and at times I have people walk up to me and say thank you for what you're doing and thank you for the job that you do. It's a very difficult job, and we appreciate what you do. Those kinds of things are probably make it all the more worthwhile when you know that people are aware of what you do and appreciative of what you do. We meet, unfortunately, on a weekly basis with victims' families, people who have lost a daughter, a son, a mother, a father, an aunt, an uncle. You know, we were at a sentencing yesterday with a mother and father who had lost their 16-year-old daughter, Melanie Kuntz. Very, very sad situations. And I think that it's important for us to make sure that those people understand the criminal justice system, that they know from all sides and all perspectives people are going to be treated fairly, that people, the decisions that are going to be made within the criminal justice system are made for the right reasons. So those are the important aspects. The worst part of the job is sometimes it's very stressful and it's very sad, and we talk about that. We say there are times when we see things that happen, again, particularly with children, whether it's child abuse, sexual assault, child death cases, that are so sad. And I think that impacts you in your own life. I know it does with my kids, my grandchildren, maybe more protective than anything about where they go and who they see. So the sadness aspect of it and the probably the stress aspect of it. We're starting a first degree murder trial next Tuesday. That'll probably last 2 weeks. It's just our job. And during the meantime, nothing else stops. We have cases that are coming in all the time. We get calls, my chief and I do, constantly with regard to the homicide unit, the police department, about ongoing investigations, whether it's 10 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning, about issues and questions. So that can be a very stressful job, but the gratification, again, far outweighs it with the teamwork that we have with law enforcement, U.S. Attorney's Office, the Police Department, the Sheriff's Office, the State Patrol, so many people to work so hard to put these cases together and to culminate in bringing justice to people and holding people accountable and responsible and maybe doing what we can to make people's lives better in Douglas County. And by that, I mean the other things that we do. You know, I have people, somebody walked up to me in the hallway the other day, said, "Mr. Klein, you don't remember me." Gave me his name. He said, I just want to tell you, you gave me the opportunity a couple years ago to go into drug court. And he goes, "And I'm doing unbelievable. I'm not using meth anymore. I got a job. I'm supporting my kids." So that's a wonderful thing to hear. So, you know, sometimes we deal with the really terrible stuff, but also there's some positive things that we hear from people that of a difference that we've made in their lives, and that's a big deal.
Tell us how you handle conflicts of interest in your office. Example, attorneys who contribute to your election campaign and also appear before your office representing defendants or civil matters against the county.
Well, the politics is probably that's another bad, worst part of the job. This to me is a position. It's a job. I try and stay away from the politics part of it. It's about working hard for the people and doing the job that I'm supposed to do and having the right people there. But certainly there, part of it is you have to campaign. Last time I didn't have anybody run against me. I'm up for election this year. Nobody's filed yet. I intend to file here in the next couple weeks and we'll see. That's part of the process. But certainly part of the campaign process is to campaign and raise money. So we're very careful Accountability and disclosure, the laws in the state of Nebraska are that anybody that contributes to your campaign, it's public. You go on a website, you can see anybody that's ever contributed to my campaign, raised funds for. And certainly we're very careful about making sure that there's not anything done from a conflict of interest standpoint. You know, we raise money, and sometimes lawyers make donations to campaigns, but it doesn't mean that our office can't handle a case against them. But we're very careful to ensure that there's not anything that's done of any improper situation with regard to contributions or that somehow we're doing a favor for somebody because they supported me in any way. But that's politics. But certainly there's something we're very, very cognizant of. And I think our office is run in an extremely ethical manner. And that's, to me, that's the most important part of the job. If you look at other countries, one of the biggest problems they have is people don't believe in their system of justice. You go to a country just south of us, Mexico, people think the police are corrupt and the judges are corrupt and the federal people are corrupt. And it destroys the whole system, the whole system of government. So I believe in transparency. You see me on the news quite a bit. It's not because I'm doing press releases. It's because they come to our office almost every day and just ask questions, and I answer questions. And I want the people to be informed, and I think that's an important role that the press plays in a democracy, that not just to spoon-feed what's said by an elected or the office to somebody, but to actually dig a little bit and ensure that what's coming out of that person's mouth is accurate or true and transparent, because that's, again, a part of the role the press plays in a democracy.
To what extent do you find it worrisome that there is a push in the legislature to release people into society sooner to address prison overcrowding?
That's another great question. Obviously, that's a subject for debate with the legislature. A concern that I have about that, and we have talked about with the police, and I've talked about it with the chief and several people, is I don't think it should just be a money issue. Okay, public safety shouldn't be just a money issue. People shouldn't get out of jail because, well, we don't want to spend any more money to build a new prison. Well, if we have to build a new prison, that's just part of the process. And I'm not saying that we do, but when I see cases that we handle, and I know the judges of Douglas County and the job that they do, and they have a difficult job, they don't usually send somebody to the penitentiary unless a person really needs to go there. So, I mean, we have, you know, all those things that we talk about, we try and do that on the front end of things. I really believe that. That's why we have a drug court. That's why we have mental health diversion. That's why we have a young adult court. That's why we have probation. All those things are things that the judge has to do, or we have from the front end, to prevent that person from going to the penitentiary. So when I see the sentences of people that go to the penitentiary, I know that there's a lot of thought process that goes into that from the judges and obviously from us. So if that person's being sent there, there's a reason. My concern in that regard is public safety. And I agree that public safety also has to do with when these people that are put in prison are going to get out. And I think that there's some good ideas about before we let somebody get out of the penitentiary, or if we're going to let somebody out, let's have some supervised release for a while. Let's see how they're going to do for a while. Let's give them some tools maybe to work with when we're going to release that person from the penitentiary. So I think that supervised release on the other end, like the federal system does quite a bit of, is something that might be very important. So, but I guess my goal is public safety, and I want to make sure that our community is safe, and the people who are really violent offenders, the people out there who hurt people, don't get an opportunity to hurt people again. So,
how long does it usually take from arrest to the trial? And two words, Garcia ? Jenkins ?
That's a good question. I wish I knew the answer to it. We don't have control over that. You know, we have, in Nebraska, constitutionally, a person has a right to a speedy trial. In Nebraska, once the information's filed in district court after the preliminary hearing, there's a law that says we have to try the case within 6 months of the time that information's filed. So I know you say, well, Klein, come on. I know that some of these cases are there for a year, or a year and a half, or 2 years before they get tried. Well, what happens if the defendant files a motion to suppress, if the defendant files a motion to continue, if the defendant files a motion for a competency or an examination with regard to insanity? That stops the clock. So that time period is not counted against us then. So all those things are somewhat out of our control. We'd like to get the cases tried as soon as possible, but it's either a discovery issue, a pretrial motion issue, and that's the natural course of or progression of business. So we don't really know how long it's going to take. I mean, I'm anticipating those two cases might get tried this next summer, but that it all depends. I mean, you've all seen the news that Mr. Jenkins now has been found competent by one doctor, incompetent by another doctor, and we have a hearing set to what the judge is going to decide with regard to his competency, which means his ability to stand trial. It doesn't have to do with insanity. It's just his ability to assist in his own defense. So we'll see what kind of ruling we get on that, and that'll push the case forward. If he's found to be competent, then we can start moving forward again. But that's a good question, but it's depends on what motions are filed and where we're at within the criminal justice system. But before we get to a jury trial, all those pretrial issues have to be taken care of.
What do you attribute to the cause of the rise in crime with regards to the under 18 population?
And I wish I could tell you that I had the answer to give you in that regard. And it's not something that only I think about. It's something I like I said, I'm on the National Board of Directors of the County Attorneys Association. We meet regularly. We discuss these kinds of problems, the issues. When I see young people involved in crime, there's usually quite a history involved. And, you look back and you see, oh, this person, they've been in juvenile court before. There were issues with regard to their family, whether it's drug abuse, domestic violence. They weren't in school. There were issues about them not attending school. So when I see those kinds of cases, I look back historically and I say, okay, there was a family problems there. This young person's on the streets at a very young age, not being supervised, not being taken care of. They weren't in school for whatever reason. And I think those are some things that we need to address very early on, very early on. I'm talking like when somebody's 4 or 5 years old. We need to make sure kids get into the school system in the right way, that there's not a problem where they fall behind and then give up and drop out. So having a good school system, having things happen early on, assisting families early on if that's an issue while these children are still very young. One of the problems, of course, we see is there's children having children. Everybody saw the video that was made national news on CNN last week. It was the child involved was the child of the mother was 14 when she had that child. Okay, so those are the kinds of issues when you look back and you see the problems, the social problems that we have. I think we need to do everything we can, and that's one of the reasons we have all the people that we do in the juvenile court system that I have, is because if there's a chance to get to those kids early on, that's when we need to do so. But it breaks your heart, honestly, when you have, like I said, a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old or 16-year-old on both ends, somebody who's killed or assaulted and somebody who is going to go to prison for the rest of their life. Two lives are lost. So
why do I think you're not going to look forward to this question? How do you feel about legalizing pot for recreational use like Colorado and Washington? Should pot users be in jail?
I would guess that Bob Sigler wrote that question. He's back there in the back of the room. I don't know. Maybe. That's a great question. We talk about this nationally because it creates all kinds of issues. You know, we have Colorado's legalized marijuana, not just medicinal marijuana, but just for people to use. It causes problems for our state. It causes problems from a jurisdictional standpoint with regard to prosecutions federally. I have a problem. I don't have a problem with people if there's a doctor who says this person can use marijuana to help their glaucoma, or they're a cancer patient. This is the only way for them to deal with the pain, where we have medical potential issues. I am not for in any way, shape, or form people being allowed to just have marijuana. Why would we legalize something that's just going to that causes? We have enough problems just dealing with alcohol, and I'm not a prohibitionist with regards to alcohol, but. You know, we had somebody from the DEA talk to our national group a while back and say, you know, people talk about, well, heck, let's just legalize drugs and we can tax them and the government will make money off of it. And the DEA guy said, you know, think of all the issues that we have from alcohol, and we tax alcohol and we tax its use. And he goes, the tax money doesn't pay for all the DUI stuff that we deal with and the motor vehicle homicides and the people who get killed by drunk drivers. And so to say, oh, we can tax drugs and somehow or other it's going to be a benefit to our country, I don't see it. You know, and I see, honestly, I see marijuana usage. There are addiction issues for some people, not everybody, with regards to marijuana. So why throw something else out there that people can have a problem with that is going to cause some people problems, and it definitely does cause some people problems. So I just don't see it. I said from a medical standpoint, that's fine, but from a recreational standpoint or somehow that's going to be beneficial to society, I'm not for it. So that's my opinion, personal opinion.
Is the problem of violent crime in our poverty areas intractable? What are possible solutions?
Those are very good questions. I mean, I don't mean that just to say that. I mean, that's what we try and figure out or think about on a daily basis. You know, what can we do? How do we make a difference? You know, when you talk about public service, it's as what we do. It's not just prosecuting people. It's okay, we're prosecuting people. And we're in the criminal justice system, and that's our main job. But what else can we do to fix this so that this problem doesn't exist anymore? We don't want to have 32 murder cases pending in Douglas County. We don't want to have young people involved in crime. So what's the answer? It's not intractable. It's not something that we can't fix. It's definitely something that's fixable. But it's going to take everybody to fix it. When I talk to people, it's not an issue in any certain part of Omaha. It's an issue for all of Omaha. It's an issue for all of Douglas County. There's not certain areas that it's an issue for. No, this is an issue for everybody, and everybody needs to deal with it. Everybody needs to get involved about it. Everybody needs to care about it. Everybody needs to stick up for their neighbor. You know, one of the biggest problems that we have in cases is quite honestly, having people come forward and be a witness. We have, you know, great manners from an investigative standpoint. Say Crime Stoppers, which is a tremendous thing, but when somebody calls in and gives an anonymous tip that might lead to an investigation, that's great. But when we charge somebody with a crime, there's a Sixth Amendment that says, hey, the person that's charged has a right to confront the witness against them. So somebody has to get on that witness stand and testify. And so we need people to say, we need to stick together. We need to say we've had enough. We need to protect our neighbors. We need to say we're going to step forward. When I talk to kids about these kinds of crimes, and I know, you know, maybe we had a case that we had to dismiss a couple weeks ago that was at the pedestrian bridge. We had 10 people I know that were there observing what took place. People wouldn't testify. People wouldn't come forward. Said they didn't remember, didn't see anything. We have to fix that part of it. And when I talked to young people, I said, if you were there somewhere and you saw your little sister or your little brother get shot by somebody, would you want the person that saw that to come forward? And, of course, they said, sure, I would. I'd want that person to get prosecuted for doing that to my brother or sister. I said, well, just think about that. That's who that person was that got killed. Somebody's brother or sister or mother or aunt or uncle. And we have to have people that come forward. And we have to have people testify. We have to have evidence. And so it's understanding that aspect of it and saying, okay, that's the way we're going to take care of things. We're going to let our neighbor know that we're going to help them have the courage to come forward and do the right thing and testify and tell the truth. Sometimes that's easier said than done. I know that. Sometimes we'll have people in our office and they'll say, Mr. Klein or Ms. Beadle, I want to testify, but I'm afraid. And it's not just for me. It's for my family. It's my brother or sister who live here. But that's letting the bad guys win, okay? That's the whole purpose sometimes of the gang culture, the gang ideology is we want to intimidate. And we're going to scare people. We want people to be afraid of us. We want people to think that they can't come forward or somebody's going to get them or come after them. And so if we allow that to happen, we empower them. So we need to understand that as difficult as it might be at times, and everybody has to be involved, and everybody has to look out for everybody else, that, you know, we've got to help each other have the strength and courage to come forward and say, hey, we're going to tell the truth, we're going to do the right thing. And that's the way we're going to be able to prosecute these people and hold these people accountable and responsible.
A death penalty question. When was and who was the last person in Nebraska that died in the electric chair? Who will be the next? How do you feel about how long it takes?
Well, you know, I think the last person was a fellow, and I'm not sure. You know, I guess I'm just shooting from the hip here from the standpoint of the last person. There was a guy named Williams from Lincoln, and I'm not positive about that, but I think that was, and I'm not sure how many years ago that was. There's a fellow that's on death row right now from Nebraska from, I think, a murder that occurred in 1976 or 77, Kerry Dean Moore. So to me, that pretty much tells us that the things aren't working the way they're supposed to work. I've testified down in the legislature about the death penalty. I've testified in favor of the death penalty, that in certain unique, extraordinary circumstances, there needs to be this ultimate punishment. I'm not saying it's like Texas where they have executions that occur all the time, but I think Nebraska does a pretty good job of handling it. And if you know how the system works in Nebraska, we have a law that says if there's a first-degree murder charge, then there's a certain statute that says here's some what are called circumstances that occur. And if these circumstances occur, then you need to file something on that. That more than one death occurred, that the person has a tremendous history of violence, that there was several people put to in a dangerous situation when the death occurred, that it was a law enforcement officer. All those things are circumstances, aggravating circumstances. So we file that. The jury makes a determination that the person's guilty of first-degree murder. Then the jury also makes a determination beyond a reasonable doubt if there's an aggravating circumstance exists. All right? Then a judge, the Supreme Court appoints a 3-judge panel to look at the case. The defense has an opportunity to put on any mitigating circumstances they want to. And then the 3-judge panel has to vote unanimously whether the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances. If you're going to have a death penalty, I think that's a very good way to do it. And if one judge votes against the death penalty, then it's not a unanimous verdict and it doesn't happen. So I think that the way Nebraska has it set up is properly. I don't think it's something that we just do willy-nilly. We seriously consider every case. We just determine if those aggravators exist or not. But really, it's a legislative question when it comes right down to it. Do the people want the death penalty, or do the people of Nebraska not want the death penalty? Whichever way the people decide is what we'll go with. But certainly when we see – I've had two cases, like I said, that – have ended in a death penalty sentence. Roy Ellis for the death of Amber Harris and Arthur Lee Gales for the death of Latara and Tamar Chandler. Arthur Lee was convicted, I think, in 2000, maybe 4, and Roy Ellis was convicted, 5 years ago, Brenda? About 5 years ago. So they're still on death row. But that's a question. That's a legitimate question. Okay, if we have this penalty is, and we have somebody that's been on death row for over 30 years, is it really something that is effective as a deterrent in any regard or not? And so I think that's something that people have to look at, and that's the system itself has to look at with regard to it. Like I said, I think that in certain unique, extraordinary cases that it that there needs to at least be that option for a three-judge panel to decide, and only in those cases. So I hope that answered the question.
Related question. In general, do you feel judges are too lenient or about right in imposing sentences?
Are there any judges in the audience here? I don't know. The judges have a difficult job. We give them the parameters. You know, if somebody gets convicted of a crime that carries from, as a class 2 felony, carries from 1 to 50 years, and they have pretty broad parameters, pretty broad discretion as to what to sentence to. Certainly that there are times when I disagree and I am vocal about it. I question whether this person deserved it. But that doesn't mean that as long as the judge does it for the reason that they feel is the right reason, then we might have a difference of opinion, but that's their job, and I respect their job that they do. But certainly there are times when I'd question maybe we're right in the middle of it all the time, so I sometimes wish that they could put themselves in a different perspective or our shoes with what we've seen in that case or what's happened or the criminal history of the individual that's involved to make sure that this person's held accountable and responsible and that we protect our community. But they have a difficult job, and I respect the job that they do, and as long as they do what they do for the right reason, then I'm fine for what they do. We may disagree, but that's part of the job. And it's a difficult job.
What can the court system do to help young parents in prison so they are better citizens and parents when released, i.e. domestic abuse offenders, but also a murderer convicted who now will have a problem obtaining a job?
Well, you know, there have been things that have been done within the system. When we talk about the juvenile court system specifically, we've made it so that people can have records sealed so that it doesn't impact their ability to get a job. We've done them some things for adults. We have, a diversion program so that people don't get that felony conviction if it's a nonviolent offense. We have a young adult court for people who are between the ages of 16 and 22 who don't qualify for juvenile court, but we can put them in a system, a program that lasts. It's a very difficult system. Bob Blanchard runs that young adult court, and it's a program that's very difficult to get through. But if people are dedicated enough to change their lives and progress through that program, then they won't get a felony conviction. We also, like I said, have a drug court that's not an easy task to make it through to help with addiction issues that people have so that they don't get a felony conviction. So, again, we try to do it on the front end. Corrections, you know, once people are down in the correctional system, that's the State Department of Corrections. They have a manner of evaluating people as soon as they get down there to Lincoln. The first place that people go once they're sentenced is a place called the D&E, Diagnostic and Evaluation Center. And so there they are evaluated. They are assessed. What sort of problems does this person have? What can we do within the correctional system to help them? If it's a drug issue, it's a domestic violence issue, whatever issue it might be, they have educational services. But that's part of the correction systems that once they're out of our end, we don't have much to do with. But we are starting to see more people on the other end of it when people are getting out. Recently, we've had, since the Jenkins case, we've had been contacted by Department of Corrections saying, hey, this person's going to get out of the Department of Corrections tomorrow. We think you need to take a look at this person for a board mental health commitment. And so that, talk about putting things in motion in a quick fashion. and putting people a little bit on the spot. It's and we have to figure out if this person would even qualify for that sort of possibility. Board of Mental Health isn't somebody that's just, this person's a bad person, doesn't qualify you as being committed by the Board of Mental Health. You know, it's about somebody who's mentally ill and dangerous. So then we have to do a little background search and see in that regard. So we're involved from that end of the system also, and the system of, with regard to probation or parole.
Why do you think that the U.S. has so much more violent crime than other developed countries?
Another great question. Folks have done some studying before you came here today. And it's not something, you know, that I haven't looked at, and like I said, nationally that we've looked into. You know, if you look at the homicide and suicide rates, particularly by firearm, in other developed countries, there's a huge difference. It's very simple to see. If you look at Japan, if you look at Australia, if you look at some of the European nations, there's a big difference. I don't know exactly what that difference is. But I have an inkling as to what it possibly could be. So I think it's important for us to be aware of that. I think that there's a tremendous accessibility to firearms that and again, I'm not opposed to people owning firearms. I'm not the right to bear arms. It was a constitutional right. I don't want to put myself in that position, but certainly the accessibility of young people, it's hard for me to understand how a 15 or 16 year old can be have an SKS or a semi-automatic rifle, the access to that and to use it. So to me, it's like we need to make sure or ensure that folks that are using guns for the wrong purpose don't have access to them. And I think I don't know how that's done with the different differences of opinion that people have about guns in our country. But certainly you can look at other countries and see that there's a huge disparity in deaths in some of those countries compared to the United States. Canada, Japan, Australia, United Kingdom, many other countries.
Time for one last question. After you see and hear about some of the horrible things that people do to each other, is it difficult to not take that home with you every night?
You do take it home with you every night. And that's unfortunate. That's something my chief deputy and I talk about because she goes to home to her. She's got children and a husband and you know, school stuff, activities go on. I do. And you want to be able to have some sort of balance in your life. And when you see this sort of, or you're in the middle of these kinds of things pretty much constantly, it is a concern. But I think that's why I teach at Creighton. That's why I teach at the law school. It's great to be around a bunch of energetic, optimistic students. And I coach fifth grade girls basketball, and I get far more out of that, I'm sure, than the kids do from my coaching abilities. But it's just being around kids. It's being able to be part of the community. And no matter what you see here or we talk about, I mean, you turn the news. I hear people talk to me sometimes, say, I don't watch the news anymore. I don't want to watch the news. I don't want to see the bad stuff that goes on and that kind of thing. But I think it's important to know what goes on in your community. You can't bury your head in the sand about it. But as much as we're involved in stuff, we realize, or I know I do, 99.99% of the people that live in this county are tremendous family people who are hardworking, who care about their community, who care about everything that goes on in the community, and are wonderful people. There's just a very small percentage of people who are causing some of the problems that we see. So I think we need to always remember that and realize that what a great place that we live here in Omaha, Douglas County, and we really do. And the opportunities that we have for ourselves and our families that we have in Omaha, Nebraska, it's, I think, you know, when I go around the country a little with our board and I talk to other people, other DAs from other communities, I'm glad that I think sometimes people don't realize what we have right here. You know, we've got it pretty good. Yeah, when I talk to other DAs, and we live in such a great place, and it's just great to be here with you today and have the opportunity to visit with you about these kinds of issues that I know you care about, that I care about, that our community cares about. But that's the kind of people we are. We care about our neighbors. We care about our families. We want to make this community the best it can possibly be. And that's the wonderful part about living in Omaha, Nebraska. And we have great foundations. You know, when you think about it, you think of Omaha. I talk to our people around the country, and I go, we have the Sherwood Foundation here, Warren Buffett and Susie Buffett, and we have people like Mike Yanni, who do such a tremendous job and care about our community. We have the Hawkses. We have the Kiewit Foundation. We have these great foundations where people who have done very well living in Omaha, Nebraska, and having businesses in Omaha, Nebraska, who give back to this community. The Dick Holland Center. There's so many. You could go on and on and on. And it's like, this is an Omaha. People go, that's an Omaha. You know, you talk about, I say, well, you can go to Piccolo's on 20th Street, and you see a picture of Bill Gates and Warren Buffett there having lunch there at Piccolo's. And people go, really? Bill Gates in Omaha, Nebraska, and Warren Buffett having – yeah, that's just part of life here in Omaha, Nebraska. It's just the way it is. It's great people who care. So, you know, like I said, we deal with a lot of nasty stuff, but it's important for us to keep balance and realize and take a look at the good things that we have around us and in our families and enjoy it and on every day be thankful for what we have. So I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here today. If there's a question I didn't answer, please don't hesitate to give me a call or stop by the county attorney's office, and we'll make time to visit with you. We might be running around, but we could be in court. But if you sit there for a little bit, we'll get to you. But I'd love to visit with all of you and love to have contact with all of you. And if there's concerns that you have about the job that we do and how we do it, I'd love to hear from you about that. So anything else, Gary?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you for being with us today.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by Don Klein, Douglas County Attorney. Besides his duties as county attorney, Mr. Klein also serves on the board of directors of Project Harmony, as well as on the board of directors of the National District Attorneys Association. He graduated from the Creighton University School of Law in 1977. He has discussed the challenges facing the Douglas County Attorney's Office. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, January 16, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Friday, February 14th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be Brad Ashford, a member of the Nebraska State Legislature. He'll talk about the problem of overcrowding in Nebraska's prison system. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.